You are listening to the Next Best Picture podcast, and this is Will Mavity's interview with the writers and directors of Midnighters, Julius and Alston Ramsey.
What did you do?
He's gone.
Go back to the house. We need some place where we can figure things out.
There's nothing that we could have done.
Wait, that's our address. He was on his way here. Is there anything you've done that would make someone come after you?
I am Detective Smith.
Does your sister live with you?
She's with my husband.
Where did they go?
I'm trying to protect us and you're screwing it up.
There is a dead man in your garage. You're the one who brought him here.
We have to do something about this mess. What happened?
He showed up right after you left. And he knows everything about us. You can't trust Jeff. What did you say? It's gonna be all right.
How can you be so naive?
Hannah is not on our side!
Hi there, and welcome to yet another episode of the Next Best Picture Podcast. I'm your host, Will Mavity, and with us today I have the director, writer, and producer of Midnighters, a new indie film in distribution by IFC. We have with us the director, Julius Ramsey.
Hey, Will. Really glad to be here. I'm excited.
And we also have with us the writer, Alston Ramsey.
Also psyched to be on the podcast.
So, guys, I know it's been a whirlwind of a press junket. There's quite a lot to talk about your film. It's sort of a Coen Brothers-esque neo-noir. There's a lot of directions we could take this, but one of the first things that's lingering with me after seeing this film is, you know, you guys made a lot work on an indie budget. How on earth did you go about pulling off a sequence with fingernails? Because that is really sticking in my head right now.
Thanks. It's a difficult thing to pull off on a small indie film, but we had a really great special effects makeup supervisor named Brian Spears, who's done a lot of indie genre films. He's also done a lot of the Marvel shows. I believe he did The Punisher and a few others down in New York. So we met with him and we knew that was always going to be one of the big gags of the film. That's what call it in the business, a gag, if it's using, you know, special effects makeup. And he spent a lot of time making the prosthetics, and they're essentially like plastic fingers that are filled with tubes that have blood in them, and then he pumps it up so it has a certain amount of pressure. Now, the tricky part about filming a sequence like that is that the fingers themselves, you know, no matter how good you want to make it, that they're not going to look great when they're in a close-up. But when we were actually filming this, Brian, he suggested an angle, which was like a low angle looking up, so you saw the edges of the fingers poking out over the chair's handle, and we decided to, I took his suggestion. I put the camera down there, and by doing it at that particular angle, it kind of hid the weaker part of the prosthetic, so you couldn't see it. And that way, when the nail hit, you really saw it pop over and the blood spill over the front edge of the fingernail. And with some creative editing, you know, I think it really sold the gag.
So obviously, that's kind of the gruesome standout of the film. But both of you guys come back from eclectic backgrounds coming into a film like this. Now, Jute, I understand that you worked in The Walking Dead a lot, and Alston here has one of the more interesting backgrounds for a screenwriter I've ever heard. Alston, tell us a little bit about your credentials prior to becoming a screenwriter.
Sure. Out of school, I started my career as a magazine editor in New York, and after a year or so, I got an email out of the blue from Don Rumsfeld, who was the Secretary of Defense, from his chief speechwriter. And I applied for a job, and I got it, and so I started working for him about 3 months before he got kicked to the curb after the midterm elections in 2006. So I ended up being the deputy chief speechwriter for the Secretary of Defense Robert Gates from 2006 to 2010. That's sort of the heights of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then I spent a fun-filled year in Afghanistan on General Petraeus's staff, who was the commanding general at the time. I was a DC speechwriter for a number of years before sort of getting out of the political realm.
So for each of you, how did your backgrounds, both in The Walking Dead and acting as a speechwriter in Afghanistan, lead you to create this film that's sort of a domestic neo-noir? Tell me a little bit about the inspiration you both took.
Sure. I've been, I've always been interested in thrillers. It's one of my favorite genres, and I've worked on, a lot of television shows over the years that were in genre, primarily science fiction and horror. So I've been wanting to make my own feature film for a number of years, and when Alston moved to Los Angeles to pursue screenwriting, we sat down and we talked about what kind of a film we would like to make together, and we kind of came up with this storyline with the parameters that we wanted it to be a thriller that didn't rely on any supernatural conventions or any, gimmicks like some sort of strange monster, and I mean like a supernatural type monster, or really any force that was not human and somewhat grounded in reality. We also wanted to create a film that could be done at a low enough price point that if push came to shove, we could go out there and raise the money ourselves and produce the film ourselves, which is what we ultimately did. So I think those were the main parameters going into this project as to what I wanted to accomplish.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I thought was really interesting when I started to screenwrite from my background, it had always been a hobby, I guess, when I was in Washington and speechwriting. I started reading screenplays. I read books about screenplays. I took the Robert McKee seminar, which anyone who's ever written a screenplay has, like 80% of working screenwriters have probably taken. And I had no idea when I finally said, I want to write a screenplay, if I'd be any good at it. I just haven't written fiction. And what surprised me was a number of the skills that I had developed while speechwriting translated over. Two in particular, and the main one probably is writing dialogue, because it turns out when you're speechwriting, all you're doing is listening to the way people talk, and you're learning to write in someone else's words and their language and the rhythm of how they speak. And so it came a lot more easily than I thought it was. And then the other aspect, and I think this is a overlooked element of speechwriting and screenwriting, is research. Just that whether it's sort of interpersonal research or relationships you have or actual book research, I think that is the real difference between very good speeches and very good scripts and ones that aren't necessarily as good.
So you wanted to listen to how people really talk in the real world. So how was it creating a character like Smith, who is a creature from another world entirely, yet still grounded in reality? Tell me a little bit about the creation of the Smith character.
Oh, gosh. The genesis of it, I couldn't even remember right now, except that we wanted an antagonist. We wanted one that would be original and you haven't really seen before. And as we started drilling in on that, it just felt like you wanted someone that was less, scary in that sort of arch nemesis way, and that the terror would come more from the intelligence factor and the sociopath factor of someone who toys with people and is brilliant and intelligent and can kind of talk their way out of anything. And that just went down this road where he just kind of came to life as this guy that, I mean, I don't know how the best way to describe the way he talks and what he talks about. It's very esoteric stuff. And it's, does he really believe it? Is he just toying with people? I don't know. I mean, he just came to life and spoke the way he spoke. I mean, it's a very original way of talking. And, I think with the screenplays I've written, when I've gotten to a certain point of understanding the characters, they do take on a life of their own where you're writing a line and it just feels like they're saying it rather than you're putting words in their mouth.
Now, did you derive any inspiration for him from David Lynch? Because that's definitely, he felt like somebody who would be at home in a David Lynch film.
You know, I didn't explicitly think of it, but I would not be surprised if sort of planted in my subconscious as I'm sort of sitting there thinking through, you know, who are the great villains in film that I like, if some of that weirdness wasn't sort of coming through.
Now, I guess going back to Julius a little bit, tell me a little bit about how you collaborated with the production designer on a low-budget film to create these eerie interiors, because between the garage, the inn at the end, and the under-construction house, these are some very distinctive images you created. Tell me a little bit about that process.
Cool. Well, thank you very much. I'm glad you liked them. I mean, the first stage with production design is figuring out what the look and the feel of the film are going to be. I had spent a lot of time building out a lookbook, which is a 30-page document, primarily pictures, but some text, and it describes the tone of the film. It describes what the locations are going to look like. It describes how things are going to sound. It describes the mood that you're trying to set. I also created what's called a rip-o-matic in the business, which is where you take snippets from other films and you assemble them into what would best be described as a fake trailer for the movie. It's about a 2-minute piece, but it would almost serve as a trailer for our film, aside from the fact that everything in it is parceled from other movies. So after sharing those with our production designer, whose name is Allison Malillo, who's very, very talented, we had been talking, and then I also began location scouting. Because it was a low-budget film, I wound up doing all the location scouting myself.
I would just interject that he probably sifted through no less than 1,000 listings the entire state of Rhode Island. I mean, by the end of it, I was trying to help out where I could, but I couldn't because he was like, you know, he deserves a license for real estate brokerage in Rhode Island.
Yeah, I'm an honorary real estate broker in Rhode Island. But, I called tons of people, mainly it was houses on Zillow because, you know, with traditional location scouting, they typically are going back to locations they've used before and they have deals with certain people. And we just really weren't at that point, and we were filming in an area like Rhode Island where there's very little filming going on. So the strategy with finding our locations, and primarily the house, which was a central location for the film, was to find people that were selling a house but they hadn't quite sold it yet, and they might be willing to, because we were filming in February and March, they might be willing to hold off for 2 months, 2 or 3 months, until the spring, which is a better time to sell a house anyway, and for a certain amount of money essentially rent this empty house to us, at which point we would fill it up with furniture and decorations and transform it into our set. And so after we had looked at lots of houses, and Allie would go with me and Alston to look at them, as well as one of our producers, Jarrett Blankhorn, who's also very talented, we stumbled upon this house, which was much larger than the house we had envisioned in the screenplay. Jeff and Lindsay, you know, come from modest backgrounds, so we had thought it would be a, you know, 3-bedroom modest home. And we found what was can best be described as a large, gothic-looking estate, if you will. And once we looked at it, it struck such a chord with myself and with Allie. We started really thinking about how we could transform the screenplay and the storyline in order to accommodate this amazing location, which just seemed like such a wonderful opportunity for a place to in which to film. It was very cinematic. I remember it had these floors that were tiled floors in some of the rooms. It had this beautiful, giant, decrepit and scary basement, but would have been perfect for our purposes. And so that's what we did. We shifted the storyline so that Jeff and Lindsay were still at the same financial level, but they had decided to put everything on the line and purchase this giant house, which we made a lot more dilapidated. And then through a process of renovation, make it better so as they could sell it and flip it for a profit. So that becomes the part of the story, that Jeff is the one who's spearheading it. He's supposed to be renovating it himself and doing all this construction. And to that end, we went about in the production design that Allie did so brilliantly, making the house look worse than it actually was by putting in a lot of scaffolding and tarps and power saws and various kinds of equipment that one would use to renovate a house. We also did some stuff on the front of the house, like the handful of shots you see of the house's exterior. We added scaffolding to the front. We used some visual effects to put some holes in the roof. We put boards over the windows so that when the audience is watching the film, it feels like this is a large rundown house. And I think we were able to successfully sell that aspect of the location. So, I mean, that was really step one for that that location. And the other ones, I mean, you mentioned the bed and breakfast hotel that they go to. You know, in the original screenplay, it was a rundown motel, and I was looking for something out of the 50s or 60s that had some of the neon and whatnot, but I couldn't find anything like that within striking distance of where we were in Rhode Island. Everything that was crappy, if you will, it didn't have any sort of a cinematic look to it, because even when things are supposed to be worn down and in bad shape, they still need to have a cinematic feel. They need to somehow be able to pop on film and have a unique, memorable tone to it. And I stumbled across, after countless searches and coming up with different ways to look for locations, I happened upon this Victorian home that happens to be, I think it's like the second most well-preserved or longest-preserved Victorian mansion in America. And
so
it,
cool.
Yeah, it's really
so
cool.
So weird.
And it happened
10 minutes from where we're shooting.
Yeah, oh 10 God. Minutes from where we're shooting. And, you know, we contacted the owners. They've done tiny little photo shoots there before, nothing like a feature film. And it was a woman, a very kind woman who owned it and lives there along with kind of a caretaker. And they let us go there. And we were originally just going to shoot on the exterior because we never thought there was a chance they would let us shoot inside. And we you know, went over there and met, and the exterior is, you know, perfect. It's beautiful. They seem very willing to play ball. And then we asked the next question is, well, what does the inside look like? And we saw it, and it's breathtaking. And we asked if we could film there, and they were kind enough to say yes. So it really wound up working out perfectly for us. And again, we accommodated the script to that aspect of the storyline. So it's more of a creepy bed and breakfast than a rundown, you know, motel with neon signs. And I think that's one of the biggest lessons that an independent filmmaker might take from this anecdote, is that don't get so locked into what you conceptualize on the page that you ignore incredible opportunities for filming when they present themselves. I mean, we were talking about David Lynch. There's a David Lynch story that I often think about, and I always think about it whenever I'm location scouting. But if you recall on the pilot for Twin Peaks, there's a scene where they go in to find Laura Palmer's safety deposit box in the back of a bank, and there's this giant moose head, you know, stuffed moose head that's like laying on a table, and the characters open up the safety deposit box and they go through it and they talk about what they find, et cetera, et cetera. And they never comment on the moose head. It's just there. But it becomes this really iconic, memorable part of the scene. And I worked with a director years ago who directed, I think, the 7th episode of Twin Peaks. And she had asked Jade Lynch about exactly what this was and why he included it. What was the artistic significance of it? Like, what made him think to put in a moose head and put a moose head into this scene? And his answer was, because it was there. And that's exactly what happened. He went to scout the location, and they happened to have this giant moose head laying on the table, and he's like, that's great, let's leave it. You know, and so it's just really like letting yourself be open to these ideas that the universe presents and incorporating them into your art, because often, as they say, truth is stranger than fiction.
Now, you have me curious. You said you were the location scout, essentially. What other roles did you guys fulfill beyond the most obvious ones with your titles?
Any role that needed to be done, we did. Jude also found our caterer and negotiated that. And my favorite, I ended up doing a lot of the accounting work. And, you know, I do our taxes and accounting and all that, which was a tremendous amount of fun. My favorite story of that is that after we finished the shoot and we were wrapping out the location, we didn't want to pay the, you know, maybe it was $500 to get a cleaning crew in to do like a, you know, moving out type cleaning. And so we're like, well, we'll do this ourselves and save a few hundred dollars. And Jute took it on to scrub the bathrooms down. So literally the director of the film is cleaning bathrooms after the shoot so that we could save a little money, because that's just That's just what you have to do.
Well, in addition to all the floors in the house, and this is, I don't know, like an 8,000 square foot house.
Oh my God.
I washed all the wood floors with pine solvent, whatever it was. I spent about 2 days cleaning everything. After having, done pre-production on this film, not to mention putting it all together over the course of a few years, and then having what can best be described as a very taxing shoot, for some reason it was just very cathartic for me to clean and do something that was relatively mindless versus the heavy mental work that I had been doing thus far on the film, and it was a way to kind of disengage from the whole process for a few days, as well as Alston pointed out, save a few $100s.
We also, when it got to post-production, we did a lot of our own post-shoot, edited the film. We ended up doing, it's called the online version of it ourselves, where we, bought a computer and online and returned the computer, just because it ended up being a technically complicated process, because we were shooting in 4K anamorphic, and we were working with, a house where, like, they weren't used to dealing with that format, and so it just made more sense for us to do it ourselves. I mean, it's independent filmmaking. You're going to find yourself doing a lot more stuff. I mean, gosh, I ended up designing the titles that are in the film, like learning how to use the program After Effects to do it, just because, that's what had to get done.
So was this, since you cleaned the crap out of this house,
literally.
Oh God. Did that come to show itself, since the fact that, at least in the final version of the film, the cleaning sequence is one of the standout moments? Right. Was that something you always planned on dedicating such love and attention to, or did that come kind of because you had this attachment almost to cleaning the house?
No, I had no attachment whatsoever. It came out because that's what needed to be done, and we were trying to get all of our, our rental deposit back from the house.
So you mentioned it was a very taxing shoot, and you were filming in Rhode Island, which is very, very cold in the dead of winter. Can you give us any anecdotes about this process?
Sure. It was freezing cold. I mean, when we started the shoot, I'd say at night it was 10 to 15 degrees. We were filming all night for a lot of the beginning part of the shoot. Our cast were champs throughout. They got quite cold. I mean, you can see their breath in the garage at night because it's so cold. And there's a shower sequence where a character drags another character into the shower, and we discovered about 10 minutes before we were actually going to film that there was no hot water in the house. And as you can imagine, that time of year, the water was pretty darn cold.
Oh,
so the cast were champs and agreed to film it, but after they were under the water for 30 or 40 seconds, I mean, they started shaking uncontrollably because of the cold.
To make matters worse, it was our fault that there was no hot water, because when you tie into the main electrical to run your generators and lights and everything, and so 2 or 3 weeks prior, when we had done the tie-in, you cut all the electricity for 20-30 minutes and then turn it back on, and so it had killed the pilot light on the hot water heater, and no one's living there, so you don't notice that there's no hot water until 15 minutes before the one scene where, it's relevant. I thought those first few days were brutal. All night in a garage that's 10 or 15 degrees, like you said, but there's also something about a garage where the air is so still, and you've got, like, the cement floor just seems to radiate cold. And then the other time is there's a car accident at the beginning of the film, which we shot about 3 weeks in, and that was two all-nighters, outside, and it was cold. And that final night where we had this car accident scene, we're doing a lot of shooting before you get to the actual stunt, and then, you're racing against dawn, because the sun's going to come up at some point, and the second it gets too bright, you're done. You got nothing else, and you've got stuntmen and stunt drivers and all of this. And so that was an intense night. And then that shoot lost his voice. Like he had a cold and it just went out, and you're outside where you're having to yell across long distances. So at some point I became his voice, where literally he says something and I just, yell whatever he says, and I'm kind of on auto load where I'm not even hearing like what he's saying. I'm just repeating it as loudly as I can, which was just,
oh my god,
interesting giving direction to actors. I'm like, I have no idea what I'm supposed to be doing.
Yeah, it's quite frustrating as a director to lose your voice.
There's all kinds of metaphorical significance to that, I feel like. Yeah. Another question I had was, tell me about the score, because it's, you know, you had this fascinating, very organ-heavy, I guess very funereal score. Tell me a little bit about the development of that.
Sure. Our score was composed by Chris Westlake, who's a brilliant film composer. We got connected with Chris. We met with a number of people, but Chris seemed to really get the film in a way that other people didn't. He spent a lot of time at the beginning coming up with a theme for the film. That was important. One of the films that was a big inspiration for this movie is a film called Shallow Grave, which was Danny Boyle's first film from the early 90s, mid-90s. And that film has a very iconic piano theme to it. So we wanted to do something like that, like our own riff on a theme that could run through the score. And I mean, some of that stuff is, it's almost subliminal by the time it actually makes it into the finished product, but I do think it's very effective, and I think that Chris came up with a really cool score and a cool theme that ran through, and his theme, as Chris described it, it was almost incomplete. So throughout the movie, in the first half or so, you're hearing it, but it doesn't ever get to completion. It doesn't have the complete theme, and it's not until the very last scene that he completes the note, so you sort of hear the full progression of the thematic elements that he had designed, which I thought was really cool and really effective at the end of the movie. As far as the organ goes, that was just, you know, trial and experimentation. Played with a lot of different instruments, and Chris, you know, quickly settled on the organ as he felt that it conveyed a gothic feel to the film. That was one of the aspects of it that I was very interested in tonally. I like to describe our film as a gothic fairy tale on a more metaphoric and tonal level, and I think the organs were how Chris interpreted that that aspect of the movie from my end.
You see it as a fairy tale.
Well, I think he means, if you've ever read the original Grimm fairy tales, like the original German translation, they're really dark. I mean, it's very dark stuff. It's very different than, you know,
Cinderella's sisters cut off their toes to fit in the shoes, right?
Yeah. I mean, so it's much darker, twisted stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's true for sure. But I mean, I also think, emotionally speaking, I mean, often an old fairy tale, and yeah, we're talking about like the old fairy tales from, you know, Western Europe, the Grimms and Hans Christian Andersen. And even if you go back to L. Frank Baum and you read the original Wizard of Oz, I mean, the Tin Man is, he gets all his arms and legs cut off, which is how he originally became a Tin Man. I mean, that's part of the children's story. But thematically, the protagonist often starts out in a bad relationship. I mean, it's typically, you know, there's an evil stepmother, or they're, you know, parents that have abandoned the kids in the forest. And so our film, you know, it kind of begins like that. It's this couple, and they're in this bad relationship, and they're journeying through the woods, which is also an iconic part of many old fairy tales. And they have an event that occurs that sets them off on an adventure. And yes, in this case, the adventure leads them back to their house, but you know, psychologically now they're in it, and they're in a morality tale that all stems from this idea of original sin, which is how they cover up this death, and that is what leads them to their own punishment. That the way in which they deal with that, I hope, becomes cathartic for the audience, as well as there's a wolf involved, which is also a big part of old fairy tales. The wolf in this case is a human wolf, and is a human monster that appears at their door about halfway through the film, you know, and he's masking himself in this case as a detective, which is just like, you know, the wolf masking himself as Little Red Riding Hood's grandmother, that kind of thing. I mean, those are the elements that I was looking for. And, you know, in terms of the color palette of the film, I wanted it to have an elevated look. So while it's realistic, it's slightly removed from real life. Like, things are accentuated from the lighting to the production design, which we discussed, to the even the colors. They're sometimes muted. They're sometimes very heightened. You know, when you look at our night scenes, I mean, there's these really great blues that were introduced by our gaffer, who did an incredible job. Nia Ku, I think is his last name. He's fantastic and really helped design that color palette. We used lenses, these very rare set of lenses. They're called the Hawk Vintage 74 lenses that emulate the look of Panavision lenses from the 1970s. In that they emulate the imperfections of glass that were from these older lenses, because the glass would like slightly deteriorate. So you get some qualities in the lenses, like vignetting on the edges, things like that. And what these lenses do is they seek to emulate that look of the 70s while still employing the advantages of modern lens mechanics, which has to do with, you know, the speed at which they can focus and their ability to, you know, see in the dark, you know, how many f-stops you're going to get. And that was a real innovation that our director of photography, Alexander Alexandrov, who I've got to get a lot of mad props to, he suggested these particular lenses. And I spent a lot of time, on the phone to the manufacturers in Germany, and they were kind enough to loan us a pair of these at a very discounted rate. And what it did for me is, I think one of the issues with digital filmmaking is that everyone's trying to make everything so crisp and clean and sharp, and but the lenses and the cameras really go in that direction. But I don't know that necessarily helps the tone of a film. I mean, sometimes it's more important to obfuscate the image and to transform the image and to degrade the image in order to depict the kind of scenes and the look that we want to get. And I think that these lenses gave us a real advantage in our desire to do that, by cutting against the more high definition, crisp look that the Alexa camera that we were shooting on typically gives. By using these lenses, we were able to create something that, for, you know, to simplify it, it just looks a lot more filmic. It looks like something that was done on film.
Wow. No, it had a
You
very...
wanted to geek out about lenses,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. No, that's awesome. No, it was a very haunting, creepy aesthetic. Is that his first feature? Because I know he was a camera op, I think, on Doug Liman's The Wall recently. Is that correct?
It's possible. I'm not really sure what he's been doing recently, but that was actually his third feature. He had done a film called The Neighbor with James Caan. And then he did a very, very small, low-budget indie. And then and around that time, I met Alex. One of the things I really liked about Alex is he's done a lot of commercials and, you know, modeling shoots and music photography. But Alex has a very artistic eye, and he's done a lot of his own work that was just very original. You know, there were a lot of guys I talked to who maybe had more experience making feature films, but I didn't think that they were bringing as much creativity to the process as Alex did. And after we had our meeting and he had seen my lookbook and the Rip-O-Matic, and one of the first things he did was suggest these lenses, and I went home and looked them up, and I knew that was our guy.
So you guys have created a haunting, creepy, and apparently fairy tale-like story. I assume this is the first of many projects. Where are you guys hoping to go next with this?
That's hard to say. There's a lot of irons in the fire. I've been writing scripts the last few years as we were putting this together. So I've got some features, some of which are genre, some of them are more in sort of the biopic true crime area. I have a couple of TV shows, and Jude can speak to some of his projects. I think that there are some projects we're looking to team up on together, and then there's some that are more our own, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, I mean, ditto. I've done a lot of work in the television space, so I've directed a number of television shows, and I'm continuing to do that, as well as developing my own projects. Some are feature films, and others are television shows that I'm creating.
Well, you can check out Midnighters right now. It's in theaters in both Los Angeles and New York. It's also available streaming on iTunes, Amazon Prime,
cable, anywhere you have either a TV or an internet connection, you will be able to find it.
And MidnightersFilm.com has got a link that'll show you where to see it everywhere.
And as of this recording, currently Midnighters has topped Deadpool on the iTunes chart, so let's hope it keeps rising. Guys, thanks so much for being on. It was fascinating hearing about the film.
Thank you so much for having us. We're big fans.
And again, I Will Mavity, at Mavericks Movies on Twitter, from nextbestpicture.com. You can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, TuneIn. Thank you so much for listening.